Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Phil Dierking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
An American company says it has completed the first permitted 3D printed home in the United States. The home was shown to reporters and visitors at the South by Southwest Technology Conference and Music Festival. The event took place earlier this month in Austin, Texas. Building company Icon has developed large 3D printers that build homes with mortar, a hard and strong material. Icon uses robotics, computer software programs, and advanced materials to make houses. Jason Ballard is the company's co-founder.
So I'm standing in front of the first permitted 3D printed home in America. This house is actually printed in high winds, blowing dust, and rain.
It is important for the printing process to operate in extreme conditions, such as weather disasters. The goal is to print homes in developing countries. Icon's 3D printer is made of lightweight aluminum and measures 4.5 meters tall by 9 meters wide. The homes are printed on site, so the equipment has to be light enough to move from one property to the next. Ballard imagines that someday many 3D printers will operate around the world to make homes. It's actually a lot more simple to build a printer than it is to build a house, he said.
We ran this printer at about a quarter speed to print this house, and we were able to complete the house in less than 48 hours of print time.
Ballard says that at full speed, the printing process could take as little as 12 hours. Icon has teamed up with a not-for-profit group called New Story. Together, they are attempting to help provide a quick, cheap housing solution for the millions of people who need it most. Brett Hagler is founder and chief executive officer of New Story.
The magnitude of the problem that we face is so big, it's about a billion people that don't have one of life's most basic human needs, and that's safe shelter.
Hagler says his organization already works on housing needs with poor families in different areas. But he says that to really make a difference, the program will need to greatly expand. He added that since the 3D printing process is so much faster than traditional home building, a whole community could be built in just a few months.
That has to come through significantly decreasing costs, increasing speed, while doing that without sacrificing quality.
Hagler notes that a 3D printed home costs a lot less than a traditional home.
Traditional style, one of New Story homes, is about $6,500 per home, right? We believe over time we can get the new home below $4,000.
The goal is to bring the new building technology to the world's poorest and underserved first. New Story is currently working with local nonprofits, governments, and families to help raise money. It plans to start 3D printing homes in El Salvador later this year. I'm Brian Lynn.
China says North Korean leader Kim Jong-un agreed during talks in Beijing to discuss denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. China's official Xinhua news agency reported that Kim made an unofficial visit to the country. The visit was not confirmed until Kim returned to North Korea on Wednesday. A special armored train carrying Kim secretly arrived in Beijing on Monday and left Tuesday. Kim held talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping, who had invited him to visit, Xinhua reported. The trip was believed to be Kim's first visit to a foreign nation since taking power in 2011. Kim traveled to China with his wife, Lee Sol-ju. The two attended a welcoming ceremony and had dinner inside Beijing's Great Hall of the People with Xi and his wife, Xinhua reported. Xi promised to work with North Korea to make a new contribution to regional peace, stability, and development, the news agency said. Kim told Xi North Korea had taken steps to ease tensions and put forward proposals for peace talks. It is our consistent stand to be committed to denuclearization on the peninsula, Xinhua reported Kim as saying. Kim also said North Korea was willing to negotiate with American officials and hold a summit of the two countries. Xinhua reported that Kim said the issue of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula can be resolved if South Korea and the United States respond to our efforts with goodwill. North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency, KCNA, reported on Kim's visit to China, but it did not report on his comments about denuclearization or upcoming summits. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with Kim in late April. United States officials say President Donald Trump also plans to meet with the North Korean leader before the end of May. On Wednesday, Trump wrote on Twitter that Xi had informed him of Kim's visit to China. Trump wrote, "Received message last night from Xi Jinping of China that his meeting with Kim Jong-un went very well and that Kim looks forward to his meeting with me." Trump added, "In the meantime, and unfortunately, maximum sanctions and pressure must be maintained at all cost." In another tweet, Trump said that for years there had not been even a small possibility for peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. He wrote, "Now there is a good chance that Kim Jong-un will do what is right for his people and for humanity." A White House statement said U.S. officials saw the talks between Kim and Xi as more evidence that America's campaign of maximum pressure on the North is working. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said his government was watching the China-North Korea relationship with extreme interest. But he said North Korea must provide concrete action, not just promises, before the international community can consider any easing of sanctions. In the past, Xi also has expressed support for strong U.S.-led international sanctions on the North. The sanctions banned billions of dollars of North Korean coal, seafood, and clothing. They are aimed at pressuring Kim to re-enter talks on denuclearization. In addition to agreeing to the summit meetings, Kim has taken other actions in recent months to reduce tensions. These included halting nuclear and missile tests and permitting North Korea to take part in the recent Winter Olympics held in Pyeongchang, South Korea.
Creators of a new dating app are using people's genetics to help people find love. They claim that, with tissue from inside someone's mouth, the app can match people with others they are most likely to find attractive. The company is called Pheromore. The name is a combination of the words pheromone, the small molecules sent from the body and smelled by the people around us, and amour, the French word for love. The company says their app is based on 40 years of research showing there are 11 genetic markers proven by scientists to be responsible for attraction. Asma Mirza is the company's chief and co-creator. She said, Pheromore looks at genetics-based human attraction and social media metadata to help people increase their efficiency of dating. Rasmus Nielsen is a professor of computational biology and human genetics at UC Berkeley. He says there are some links between the 11 genetic markers, called MHC type, and attraction. However, it is still difficult to reach a scientific conclusion. There is some idea that maybe when we mate, we avoid individuals with the same MHC type. And that's what they are basing it on. It's still very, 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 very controversial as to whether humans can even do this. And there's really very little science into whether it would help us predict mates, Nielsen said. However, Nielsen added that research has shown that mice can recognize DNA that is similar to the DNA of their parents. Mice also know to avoid mating with family members. On the company website, Pheromore says, "We are constantly smelling each other's pheromone profiles and deciding how attractive an individual is without even noticing it." Pheromore names a study from the 1990s called the Sweaty T-shirt Experiment. In that study, women rated clothing worn for 3 days by individual men. The scientists found that women were more attracted to the scent of a man whose genetics were more different than their own. But Nielsen says that kind of study has never really been repeated successfully. Pheromore creators say critics are too concerned about the app's use of pheromones. They note that the app does not only look at genetic information. It also looks at a person's social media activity. This information offers a fuller picture of someone's behavior and interests. Users can connect all of their social media activity to the app. Faramore then uses its algorithm to help find matches. Users send the company a sample of tissue from inside their mouths. It takes about 2 weeks to get the test results. The test costs $19.99. Faramore also charges users $10 a month. Along with helping people find love, the company says it is also helping save lives. The same 11 genetic markers they are looking at are the same used to fight blood cancers. Faramore is working with a national cancer registry called Gift of Life. Faramore users can choose to be added to the registry to possibly be a match for someone fighting leukemia, lymphoma, or other blood cancers. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Surrender finally came for General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy he had served as a great soldier. It was mostly his military skill and intelligence that kept the South in the field so long. But even his extraordinary skill could not save the South from the industrial power of the North and its mighty armies, armies that were well-fed and well-equipped. Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully continue the story of the American Civil War.
The last chapter of the bitter four-year struggle came in April 1865. General Grant had pushed Lee's army away from Richmond and nearby Petersburg, Virginia. His Union forces had kept after the Confederates for almost a week. Lee fled westward across Virginia. His tired, hungry soldiers tried to turn south, to reach safety in the Carolinas. But always, the Union Army blocked the way. Finally, on Saturday, April 8th, Lee's army found it could flee no farther. A Union force at Appomattox Station blocked any further movement to the west. Early the next morning, Lee tried to break through the ring of Union soldiers that surrounded his army. But he failed. Nothing was left. Nothing but surrender.
Lee sent a note to General Grant, asking to meet with him to discuss surrender terms. A few hours later, General Grant rode into the crossroads village of Appomattox Courthouse. General Lee was waiting for him at the home of a man named Wilmer McLean. Lee rose as Grant walked into the house. Grant did not look like a great military leader, the chief of all Union armies. He was dressed simply. His clothes were the same as those worn by the lowest soldiers in his army. His boots and pants were covered with mud. His blue coat was dirty and wrinkled, but on its shoulders were the three gold stars of the Union's highest general.
Lee was dressed in his finest clothing. He wore a beautiful gray coat with a red sash tied around it. At his side, he carried an ivory and silver sword. The two generals greeted each other and shook hands. Grant said, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico. I have always remembered your appearance. I think I would have recognized you
anywhere. Lee said, "Yes, I know I met you then, and I have often tried to remember how you looked, but I have never been able to remember a single feature."
Grant continued to talk of their service in the Mexican War. He said later that he did so because he was finding it difficult to bring up the question of surrender. Lee took part in the light talk for several minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose, General Grant, that the purpose of our meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to learn upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant answered, "The terms I propose are those I offered in my earlier note to you. That is, the officers and men surrendered will not take up arms again, and all your weapons and supplies will become captured property."
Lee said those were the conditions he had expected. He asked Grant to put the terms in writing so he could sign them. "Very well," said Grant. "I will write them out." It took him several minutes to write the surrender agreement. Only once did he look up. He had just written the sentence, "The arms, artillery, and public property will be given over to the Union Army." Grant stopped writing and looked over at the sword the old general wore. He decided there was no need to hurt Lee's pride by taking away his sword. So he added, "This will not include the sidearms of the officers, nor their horses, or other private property. Each officer and man shall be allowed to return to his home. He will not be disturbed by United States authorities as long as he honors this agreement and obeys the laws where he lives."
Grant gave the paper to Lee. Lee read it slowly. When he finished, Grant asked if the Confederate general wished to propose any changes. Lee was silent for a moment. "There is one thing," he said. "The cavalrymen and artillerymen in our army own their own horses. I would like to understand if these men will be allowed to keep their horses." "You will find," Grant said, "that the terms as written do not allow it. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." "You are correct," said Lee. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear."
Until now, Lee's face had shown no emotion. But for a moment, his self-control weakened. Grant could see how badly Lee wanted this. "Well," said Grant, "I did not know that any private soldiers owned their horses. But I think that this will be the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so. I think that the surrender of this army will be followed soon by that of all the others. I take it that most of your soldiers are small farmers and will need the horses to put in a crop that will carry themselves and their families through the next winter. I will not change the terms as they are written, but I will tell my officers to let all the men who claim to own a horse or mule take the animals home with them to work their little farms."
Lee was pleased with this. He told Grant, "This will have the best possible effect upon the men. It will be very gratifying and will do much to help our people." While waiting for the surrender papers to be copied, Grant presented Lee to the other Union officers in the room. Lee had known some of them before the war. After a few minutes, Lee turned to Grant. He told him that his army held about 1,000 Union soldiers as war prisoners. He said that for the past few days, he had no food but cracked corn to give them. He said he had nothing to give his own men to eat. Grant called in his supply officer and ordered him to feed the Confederate army. He told him to send to Lee's army enough food for 25,000 men.
Finally, the surrender papers were ready. Grant and Lee signed them. Lee shook hands with Grant and walked out of the house. Lee got on his horse and rode slowly back to his army. As he entered Confederate lines, men began to cheer, but the cheering died when the soldiers saw the pain and sorrow in Lee's face. Tears filled the old man's eyes. He could not speak. Soldiers removed their hats and watched silently as Lee rode past. Many wept.
A crowd of soldiers waited at Lee's headquarters. They pushed close around him, trying to touch him, trying to shake his hand. Lee began to speak. "Boys, I have done the best I could for you. Go home now, and if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well. I shall always be proud of you. Goodbye, and God bless you all." From the crowd came a loud cry. "Farewell, General Lee. I wish for your sake and mine that every damned Yankee on earth was sunk 10 miles in hell."
On the other side of the lines, Union soldiers began to celebrate. Artillerymen fired their guns to salute the victory over Lee. Grant heard the artillery booming and sent orders that it should stop. "The rebels are our countrymen again," he said. "We can best show our joy by refusing to celebrate their downfall."
General Grant left Appomattox Courthouse to return to his headquarters a few kilometers away. Suddenly, he stopped his horse. He had forgotten to tell President Lincoln or War Secretary Stanton that Lee had surrendered. He sat down at the side of the road and wrote a telegram to Secretary Stanton. News of the surrender reached Washington late on Sunday. Most citizens in the capital did not learn of it until early the next morning. Then cannons began to boom out over the city. Crowds rushed to the White House to cheer the president. They asked Lincoln to make a victory speech. Lincoln said he had not prepared a statement. He wished to wait until the next night. He asked the people to come back then, and he would have something to say.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.